From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone, breaking my stereotype with sports news.
Insanity continues.
And the legend grows. Jeremy Lin, the NBA's newest superstar, hits a last-second shot to lift his New York Knicks.
The Jeremy Lin Sanity Tour continued its incredible ride in Toronto last night.
I've got a raging case of Linsanity. I have been declared legally Linsane.
Talk about breaking stereotype. Jeremy Lin is a 23-year-old Harvard grad and the current starting point guard for the New York Knicks. He was a bench warmer until a few weeks ago when, due to happenstance, Lin got some playing time and played unbelievably well. Now he's famous. And he's Asian American. From a New York Post headline titled Amazian to an article in The Atlantic attributing his skill on the court to an Asian holistic view of the world, Lin's race is as much of a story as his game-winning shots. The attention has been mostly well-intended, says NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca, but not entirely.
There was a tweet by a boxer named Floyd Mayweather, and he said something along the lines of, you know, what Jeremy Lin is doing is ordinary for a black athlete to do. If a black athlete did it, no one would be paying attention. That was embarrassing, but everyone's pretty on board with loving a Cinderella.
Right. They love Cinderella, but they can't seem to love him without making observations about his race.
Just because someone talks about race doesn't mean that that motivation of that person is racist. And I think it's totally legitimate to note that he's the first Asian American in the NBA in over 50 years. That, in fact, in college, in Division I in college, there were only 19 Asian Americans when he was playing. That this has become such a huge phenomenon in the Asian American community and in Asia itself. That's all legitimate. And I see it more along the lines of a positive racial or ethnic celebration. It belongs in the conversation in the same way when Tiger Woods established himself as a great golfer. People rightly noted, wow, this has an opportunity to open up the sport to a demographic that, you know, didn't care about golf before.
So when the New York Post has a headline like Amazian, that's fine. But, you know, talk about stereotyping, that boxer's tweet that you mentioned.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that he was expressing the unspoken prejudices of, you know, black people have height and muscles, and Asians are small and brainy.
Basketball is 75% African American. And so when anything unusual happens, I mean, this is the definition of news, it's new. But it's not just that Asian kid does well, right? If Jeremy Lin were the number one overall draft pick, perhaps the Asian angle wouldn't be so prominent because we'd have had a chance to digest it.
It's because he's Linderella.
Yeah, it's the three things going on at once. It's Harvard, it's Asian American, and it's consistently cut, never given a chance. Therefore, it came out of nowhere. Oh, and then, of course, the fourth angle, it's New York, basketball and media capital of the world. And you take away any one of those things, and I think it becomes a compelling sports story. But with the mix of all those things, it becomes a story that you know about.
Even me.
Yes. And my only problem with the Lin coverage is just the amount of it. I mean, Thursday on ESPN began its coverage on SportsCenter with, I think, 8 minutes of Lin highlights. There was setup to the story. There were the highlights of the game. There was reaction from the teammates. There was Lin's quotes. And there was an expert breaking down how he did what he did. Then they did some football stories. And then at 15 minutes after the hour, they have little slugs that they put on the side of the screen. And here were the stories they were going to cover. Linsanity reigns. Lin an all-star. Stephen A. on Lin Mania, Hype at Garden, Mello on Lin, How Good Can the Knicks Get? And by the way, that one story, Lin and All-Star, here's the story, you ready? During the slam dunk contest, he'll be lobbing the ball to his teammate. And I swear, they prefaced it with an unironic, this just in. Although maybe they said, this just Lin. So what we have to do as sports fans is just repeat the mantra, I will not let oversaturation ruin a great story. I will not let oversaturation ruin a great story.
How much of this has to do with the fact that it's so easy to rhyme with Lin?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I saw David Letterman's list of worst Lin puns, and they were really good.
At number seven, Lin International House of Lin Cakes. Number six, Newt Lingrich. Number five, Interest-bearing investment-grade financial instrument.
There's another thing, name-wise. I think he benefits from the fact that he's always the two-name guy in the announcer's throat. So it's always Stoudemire passes, Chandler gets the ball, and Jeremy Lin with the flush. It's always Jeremy Lin breaks down the defense. So that's kind of nice for name recognition.
Mike, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mike Pesca covers sports for NPR.
From undrafted to talk of the league, from afterthought to all over TV. I tell you, hard work is the key, but this is what can happen when you dream. I'm Jeremy Lin.
Gets the ball. Может быть, нашей только...
What you're hearing is a demonstration in Moscow not long ago. It's interesting for a couple of reasons. First, this is a news spot on Russian television. For years, Russian television has been a window on the world, as the Kremlin would like you to see it. But Russian presidential elections on March 4th could return Vladimir Putin to power for yet another six-year term. That seemingly endless lock on power has been the source of mounting protests in the last few months, creeping onto Russian television. Which brings us to the second thing that's interesting about this clip. The woman that you hear speaking out against Putin, Ksenia Sobchak, had her own TV show where she criticized Putin until it was canceled this week. No one knows exactly why, but there are suspicions that she went too far. But what is too far these days? A cop show called Glukar recently concluded after three blockbuster seasons. According to Alessandra Stanley, TV critic for the New York Times, it showed something that was once thought unshowable.
Glukar, which just went off the air when I got there, but was immensely popular, and it's basically about a police officer who is a good guy and a very good detective. It's just that occasionally he has to take a bribe. Apparently the Minister of Interior told some Russian newspaper that was his absolutely favorite show.
So that's the last 10 years. Let's talk about the last 6 months. Who is Ksenia Sobchak, and how has her TV career developed in this tumultuous time?
Well, she's sort of become... overnight, the it girl of the anti-Putin protest movement. She started as a host of a reality show that's called Dom Dva, and it's basically Big Brother. It's a bunch of people stuck in a house forever. And she was the ditzy blonde host of that show. But she's also the daughter of someone you probably knew, which was Sobchak, the mayor of St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. So she was connected to the Putin family. And then when the protest movement started, she kind of sided that way and started tweeting. And she just had a show on MTV that was canceled.
Why?
Well, the first show is all about what's wrong with Putin. So that could have been it. Or it could just be ratings.
She speaks to digital natives. She's young. There is a generational divide. Russia can't really effectively censor its own internet. Was this a way for Putin to flex his muscles where he has them on TV?
The assumption is, well, the government shut her down. And it could just be that MTV decided on its own. But the Putin administration is concerned about all this sort of anti-Putin activity among the young on the internet. Not enough, really, to lose the election, but enough to really feel like they're being challenged by a class of society that they thought should be grateful. He needs to get above the 50%. Is it 50%? To win without a runoff. There's no chance he could lose the actual election, but there's a chance he could be forced to go for a second tour.
Putin's using TV to his full advantage. He's embarrassing his rivals.
Right.
Give me an example.
A news item about the opposition leaders on vacation. And you had very improbable pictures of Boris Nemtsov, bronzed and in a bathing suit in Israel. And Navalny, the protest blogger, is seen in Mexico. And you don't actually see him in Mexico, but then they show pictures of Mexico. So that, so that must be true.
And this is all on Russian television, where 70% of Russians get their news.
Exactly.
And yet, newscasts that once ignored the protests are now interviewing opposition members.
After the protest movement started for real, it just became too big to ignore. And so the only way the Kremlin-friendly networks could deal with it is to say, okay, well, we'll have a little bit about it. We won't change anything else. So they'll cover a meeting, or they'll cover a protest, or they'll cover a rally quite neutrally. And then you flip back into attack shows where you see the opposition in their true colors.
You wrote that for viewers, the effect of watching Russian TV was bipolar, a little bit NPR, a little bit North Korea.
Well, because one second you're watching a segment about the protest rally that just happened and tens of thousands of people marching in the street, and the next moment, 10 minutes of Vladimir Putin inspecting a factory somewhere, and there's no cutting to the next segment. You just stay with him. So it looks like an American television show up to a point, and then it suddenly doesn't.
We have no way to know if Ksenia Sobchak's MTV show was killed by Putin. But the opposition newspaper Novaya Gazeta is worried about pressure from the Kremlin now. And of course, Echo Moskvy, the plucky radio station that, as Putin says, regularly pours diarrhea all over him, has undergone a shakeup recently. Its board was shuffled at the behest of the Kremlin. You say that the government has always tolerated a little criticism because, quote, it gives Russia's disaffected intelligentsia a place to blow off steam. It's a little like a rich father who gives his daughter's snooty hipster boyfriend a job. He may hate the kid, but it's one way to get some peace and quiet at home. That's what Echo Moskvy was,
exactly.
That hipster boyfriend. Suddenly, the father seems to be swatting it down, and this is after a decade of, quote-unquote, diarrhea.
They didn't fire the lead journalist, and it doesn't mean that Echo Moskvy is going to change entirely. It more sounds to me like a warning. This time, Dad is kind of angry, and he doesn't want to lose this election, so don't go too far.
Alessandra, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alessandra Stanley is the TV critic for the New York Times, recently back from Russia. Coming up, the connectedness of the internet encroaches on the turf of a medical journal giant and changes the shape of knowledge itself. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and healthcare. On the web at RWJF.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. At WallaceFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. From the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology to the European Journal of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery, the multinational media giant Elsevier is the 900-pound gorilla of scholarly publishers. And Elsevier's customers, research institutions, and universities say that it's acting like a gorilla, placing a stranglehold on the specialized information it provides. But now it seems the internet is eroding Elsevier's once invincible power, inspiring its customers to fight back with a boycott. Rick Carr reports.
Let's say you run a magazine. You don't pay your writers. You don't pay most of the editors who decide which articles appear. And you don't even print on paper anymore. You're running an e-publication. So, how much should a subscription cost? In a reading room at Columbia University, I put the question to Jim Neal, who's in charge of the school's libraries. He couldn't answer the question directly because he's signed non-disclosure agreements with journal publishers. So instead, he asked me a question. If I were buying a car right now, how much would it cost?
How much would it be to buy the car outright?
A halfway decent car that I would like right now, $20,000.
Okay. Each year, for one journal, I can buy one of those cars.
Now multiply that by the hundreds of journals available in a typical university library. What's more, Neil says, publishers restrict what librarians can do with those journals. If a school has to cancel a subscription due to budget cuts, for instance, its faculty might lose access to back issues. They might not be able to loan journals to other institutions or let members of the general public read them. Neil says for years, he and other librarians have been telling university administrators that journal publishers were putting scholarship at risk.
We pay too much. We give too much away. It takes too long to get from the author to the reader. And you, university, you don't care about this problem.
Neil and other librarians say the root of the problem is industry consolidation. Three publishers dominate the field, but the Dutch multinational Elsevier is the giant. It publishes 2,651 scholarly journals, and it's a lucrative business. Elsevier's profit margin is 36%, higher than News Corp's, higher than Viacom's, and even higher than Google's.
Looking at Elsevier's profits, it is obvious that they're making a lot of money on the backs of work done by academics for which they're not paid at all.
That's Cambridge University mathematician Timothy Gowers.
We are in a position now with the internet to change and do everything much more cheaply.
On January 21st, Gowers wrote a blog post in which he said he'd never again submit a paper to an Elsevier journal, nor would he agree to serve as a peer reviewer for the firm. He asked other scholars to join his boycott and suggested that someone should build a website that could serve as an online manifesto and petition. The math world took notice because Gowers is one of its superstars. He holds a distinguished chair at Cambridge, and he won the discipline's highest honor, the Fields Medal. Halfway around the world, Tyler Nalen, a young mathematician at a Silicon Valley startup, took up Gowers' challenge.
Within about 24 hours, I think the site was up and people started signing on.
By the middle of last week, more than 6,000 scholars had joined the boycott. Nalen says one of the things that's crystallized support is the status of taxpayer-funded research. Right now, scientists who get federal grants to conduct health research must make their results available to the public online for free. Elsevier supports a bill that's making its way through Congress that would override that mandate and cut off taxpayers' free access to that research. Nalen says that just isn't how scientists think.
They want as many people as possible to know about their research. They do not want to give up the copyright. They do not want it to be behind a paywall.
Nalen says even more scholars would sign up for the boycott if it weren't for the prestige associated with some of Elsevier's journals.
You want to publish in the best journal in the world.
Heather Joseph runs a scholarly publishing reform group called Spark.
And unfortunately, right now, many of the best journals have been exclusively owned by commercial companies. So in order for, you know, a professor or faculty member to be able to get tenure, promotion, new grants, they've had to publish in these journals.
Elsevier says the boycotters have their facts wrong, that the per-article cost of scholarly publications has actually fallen over the past 10 years. And Elsevier says it has to put a lot of effort into quality control. Alicia Wise is director of universal access for the publishing firm.
We have full-time scientific editors who are mediating the peer review process, finding editors, finding reviewers, ensuring those reviews are returned on time. They also are tasked with guaranteeing that the published articles are bias-free.
Wise says Elsevier also spends a lot to keep articles in the digital domain, to make sure they're searchable and that there are multiple online backup copies. At the same time, she says Elsevier is facing mounting costs of its own as China and India increase their investments in research and development.
And those investments mean that more scientists are being employed, more research is being carried out, and more articles are produced. And that means publishers are doing more work, they have more submissions, and we're incurring the cost of ensuring the peer review and the quality control happens.
Wise says Elsevier hasn't done a very good job communicating with scholars, so she's been going online to try to explain the company's business model to the boycotters. But Tyler Nalen, the Silicon Valley mathematician who created the boycott website, says Elsevier's critics already understand the company's business model pretty well.
They have three entire sectors of volunteer workers producing skilled labor of top quality work. It's brilliant, really. What's wrong is that researchers don't need to go through that system anymore. It just exists because historically it really was useful. They really were providing value that couldn't be provided elsewhere.
Nalen says the goal for now is to convince universities, librarians, and researchers to rebel against the dominance of for-profit scholarly journals. The boycotters aim to galvanize that rebellion online. So call it the academic spring. That's the phrase used by the British publication New Scientist, which is actually owned by the same parent company as Elsevier. For On the Media, I'm Rick Carr.
Elsevier is the largest journal publisher, but the title for the oldest continuously published medical journal in the world belongs to the New England Journal of Medicine, which celebrates its 200th birthday this year. Unlike Elsevier, the New England Journal of Medicine makes taxpayer-supported research freely available only 6 months after publication. The government requires that it be made free after a year. And journal editor-in-chief, Dr. Jeffrey Drazen, says that's not all his journal gives away.
If you sign in from one of the 100 poorest countries in the world, as defined by the World Bank, our servers automatically recognize you as a fully paid subscriber. The other thing that we do is that whenever we publish something that we believe has an immediate public health impact, articles about H1N1 flu, about the SARS epidemic, we put that information up for free from day zero.
Cast your mind back to 1812. The journal was being delivered on horseback. What was medicine like back then?
So there were big differences. We didn't have the germ theory of disease. We thought that infection, which was common, was caused by miasma, bad air. And it was Louis Pasteur that proved that that was wrong in the 1860s. If you needed to have a tooth pulled or a leg amputated because it had been hurt in an accident, we had no anesthesia.
Bloodletting was a popular treatment, and in fact, the New England Journal for a while was a big proponent, right?
So the journal was proponent of a lot of things that have turned out to be wrong. I think that the key thing about the journal's editors over 200 years is that we took the current science and asked, what were the data to support it? And back then, people had clinical experiences that said bloodletting worked. But over time, it became pretty clear that this was probably making people worse, and it dropped off the page.
What do you think the biggest mistake the New England Journal of Medicine made? Was it pathologizing homosexuality or supporting Nazi-style eugenics?
It's impossible to know. There were some pretty bad things. The editors were against the admission of women to medical school. So I think the key thing is to recognize you've made a mistake and to make progress, and we've tried to do that too.
How have the standards for medical journals changed? I mean, in terms of the structure of peer review and that kind of thing.
So in 1812, if you go back and read through our archives, one of the physicians who was also a subscriber would write in and tell you about his experience, and people would then comment on whether they agreed or disagreed with it. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, people reported big effects, the first x-ray, the first treatments of infections with antibiotics, effects that were so big that we didn't need statistics. Then in the late 1940s, early 1950s, people started to look for things with smaller effects, the effect of streptomycin on tuberculosis. And those trials, because not everybody was prevented from getting polio, or not everybody was cured from tuberculosis, had to be placebo-controlled. We say, okay, you've got to prove to me as the editor that it's really your treatment that's made the difference.
What do you think is the biggest achievement of the journal?
What's been reported in the New England Journal? The first treatment in a remission of childhood leukemia in 1948, lumpectomy in breast cancer in 1981, the first identification of GRID, GRID-related immune deficiency, which we now know as HIV-AIDS, 1981. Just a few of the hundreds of things that we now take for granted in medicine because they were reported, adopted by many physicians, found to help patients get better, and then continuously used. Actually, the journal doesn't make achievements. We publish them. But when you ask a doctor, without any prompting, what do they believe is the most likely source of medical truth? They name the New England Journal of Medicine.
I actually like the cure for cholera that the New England Journal championed back in 1832. 100 drops of laudanum mixed with nearly as much of the essence of peppermint in a wine glass and filled with brandy. I could use some of that right now.
Right. So, in fact, if you add a lot of the laudanum and brandy, you don't really need the peppermint.
Dr. Jeffrey Drazen is the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Drazen, thank you very much.
Bye, Brooke.
Our knowledge of the world continually evolves, but one thing seems immutable. Everyone is entitled to his own opinions, but not to his own facts. So said Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, laying out the fundamental guarantee of knowledge that facts will ultimately settle our disputes and bring us together. But as knowledge moves onto the internet, the nature of knowledge is shifting as well. David Weinberger is senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society and author of the new book, Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. He says that the traditional approach to knowledge was to sort out the precious wheat from the worthless chaff.
Knowledge was highly filtered. So there was a huge conceivable set of things people were saying, opinions being spouted, and knowledge, it was a tiny percentage of all the things that are said. Facts would be carefully exposed, sometimes at great personal expense, and each of these facts would go together to make this picture of the world as it is.
Darwin took 7 years to find one fact?
Yep. The question was whether barnacles are mollusks or crustaceans. And they had been classified as mollusks. 7 years later, Darwin nailed it in two volumes that, in fact, they're crustaceans. Now, that's a fact.
And you use the example of the platypus to describe the limitations of the pre-digital approach to knowledge.
It's actually getting hard for us to remember this, but for millennia, the idea of knowledge was to discover what the place of something was in the order of the universe. And so the platypus didn't fit into the categories that we had already decided were the right ones because it's sort of a mammal. It's got a beak. It lays eggs. It's not well designed for these categories.
Many thought the platypus was a hoax.
Even when they saw one, when one was shipped to England and it had eggs in it, the belief in these categories was so strong that they looked at it and said, this cannot be.
You say now knowledge is taking a new shape.
So the system of knowledge that we had developed for ourselves is in many ways a system of stopping points because the medium of that knowledge was paper and books. And for all of their glory, the links in them don't work. The footnotes are broken. When you go to click on them, you don't actually get taken to the next book. So books are a very disconnected medium. As knowledge goes on to the internet, knowledge is turning into this huge mass of contradictory connections that you can travel along forever.
If you inch up your long title, you say, now that the facts aren't the facts, isn't that a fundamental problem that everybody can hold on to their facts and there's never a forum in which they ever can be disproved?
I am certainly not saying there are no facts. What I'm saying in that little bit of the subtitle is the facts aren't the facts. We're not going to agree. And that means that facts are not going to settle the issues we want them to settle. There is no conceivable additional evidence to convince Americans that our president was not born in Kenya. Yet a sizable percentage of Americans continue to believe that. Facts are not going to settle our disputes.
You say that at last we have a medium that is big enough for knowledge.
When you have a medium that is unrestricted in how much it can handle, as the internet is, we are better able to investigate an idea without stopping points. We're able to get explanations at every level of expertise. You want to know about faster-than-light neutrinos and you don't have any math, you will find some really good explanations. And if you're a physicist, you'll find really good explanations there as well. The ecology of knowledge has filled out the ability of people to engage in discussions and to get additive knowledge and perspectives is orders and orders of magnitude better than it was.
So we can be better and smarter if we want to be. We have the technology.
Yeah, because this is an awesome time to be a knowledge seeker. No better time, but it's also the best time in history to be a complete idiot. So the question is, how can we make this infrastructure better? Things like supporting open access, putting information out in ways that enable it easily to be found and hooked together with other information, recognizing that knowledge needs to be something that happens in public. If you look at how software developers learn, if they have a question, a problem with a program they're writing, they will go on the web and do a search, and they will get answers and discussions about answers and the code itself and then improvements of the code. This is maybe the best rapid learning environment we've ever had in human history. It assumes that learning is something that should be done in public. Other people can find it. You've just made the public a little bit smarter.
What makes this era of knowledge better than the last one?
Our old idea of knowledge was too restricted. The world is gigantic. We need knowledge that scales as large as the world. We now have an infrastructure that lets us do that. But the nature of knowledge changes dramatically so that it includes difference and disagreement as a part of knowledge itself. It's something we can all contribute to. It gets better as we do so.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Weinberger is a senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society and author of Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. Coming up, the media are allowed in California Children's Court. Is that a net gain for kids? And why Adele makes us cry. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Anthony Shadid, foreign correspondent for the New York Times, died Thursday, apparently of an asthma attack. He was reporting from Syria, where he'd slipped over the border. I spoke with him last year, just after he and three of his colleagues were released after having been captured and abused by the forces of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. I asked him what went through his mind when he was captured.
When we were taken, our biggest concern was that we'd be forgotten. You know, we were four people in it. Conflict is raging around you that involves millions. We were obviously very lucky and treated much better than we probably could have been. But I think selfishly, when you're in that situation, you do hope that you're not going to be forgotten.
In 2002, he was shot in the West Bank. That Shadid put himself in danger goes without saying, but he did so to tell us stories about people so often in conflict, we might overlook them.
You know, we don't leave the story just because, you know, people aren't interested in the story. I think a lot of journalists will feel it is almost a mission to cover these stories when no one cares about them.
Anthony Shadid was one of the best. It's a great loss. Michael Nash, a long-serving Los Angeles judge, issued an order reversing a near prohibition on journalists reporting from inside the state's dependency courts. Dependency courts are where things like foster care and child abuse cases are heard. Before Nash's order, journalists had to prove they had a reason to be in the court, and they were rarely successful. Allowing reporters in will give them a chance to report on many children who are at risk in the child welfare system. Now they mostly get media attention when it's too late to do them any good.
A foster mother is under investigation in the murder of a 2-year-old in her home.
This is a tragic story about a 6-year-old boy who tried to save himself from abuse.
The investigation of two separate beating deaths of toddlers. County social workers were supposed to be on top of those cases.
Los Angeles Times reporter Garrett Theroff has reported on dependency courts for the last 3 years. He says the view from the courtroom will be much broader than what he had before.
There are 35,000 children under the oversight of Child Protective Services right now. We don't have a very good idea of what a cross-section of those cases is really like.
Does being inside the court mean that you can now report on anything that you want? Do you have any limitations?
There are still a lot of limitations. You know, when we go to a criminal court or a civil court, we're able to ask follow-up questions of the attorneys. We're able to pull case records. In dependency court, I'm limited to only the oral remarks that are spoken in the courtroom. And some of the lawyers have actually gone to great lengths to try to obscure the facts. They've asked the judges not to read the allegations against the parents involved, and they've also jumped through linguistic hoops to obscure the facts of the case. One of the children's attorneys last week started referring to her clients as minor number one, minor number two, minor number three, minor number four. And that actually provoked a pretty stern response from the judicial officer involved. That particular courtroom had a referee, not a judge. And the referee said, we're supposed to be trying to make this more of a human process, and I really object to you assigning numbers to your clients. I should point out, by the way, that the LA Times typically does not use identifying material for abused and neglected children anyway.
You can't ask follow-up questions. A lot of the documents are still sealed. A lot of times the lawyers will use verbal gymnastics to keep relevant information from you. So what's the point? What do you get out of this experience that you didn't get last month?
Over the past 3 or 4 years, there have been over 70 kids who have died. And we have definitely been able to see some of the systemic flaws in the system. We've seen that social workers don't have the information that they should. We've seen that they don't have even mobile devices to communicate with the home office and access information about the cases that they have right in front of them. What we're not seeing are the bulk of the children who never die, who are never injured, but still have some pretty bad outcomes. Unfortunately, here in Los Angeles, half of the kids who come out of the foster care system are unemployed in the years immediately after they emancipate. Another third are homeless. 20% are incarcerated. And I think we want to understand the reasons behind those really terrible statistics a lot better.
So let's take an individual case you've written about, that of Tori Sandoval. She was battered and starved and eventually killed when she was sent back to her biological parents after living with a foster family. Do you think that a reporter in the courtroom might have improved Tori's situation?
I think it can. In the case of Tori Sandoval, there were a lot of complaints about the conduct of the judicial officer who heard the case. There were allegations that that commissioner did not listen to all the evidence, cut people off before they could speak. There were also allegations that the proceeding was very brief. That's something that we know happens quite a bit in California. There was a study a few years ago that found that, on average, hearings lasted only 10 to 15 minutes. And I think if a reporter was there, we could better assess what's being missed, what isn't being considered. When a reporter's present, people are also likely to raise their game a little bit and try to do a better job. My phone has been ringing off the hook with parents who want me to come to their hearing, believe that something really inappropriate is happening in their child's case, and feel that the press would be helpful to their children's best interests.
There's a principled argument on both sides of this debate. You can see some downsides to having your colleagues present in the court, right?
Yeah. I think that one of the things that is nagging everyone is the fact that under this blanket order allowing the press in, the child doesn't have final say about whether the reporter gets to remain in the courtroom. Even though we're not likely to write about the situation of children who don't want to be in the paper, I know that just me sitting there can cause distress for some kids in the system, and I definitely worry about that.
I guess the really sad thing is that if one child doesn't want the press in the court, it almost doesn't matter in the long run because there's so many cases to choose from.
That's certainly true. The one very clear thing is that there is no shortage of tragedies going on in the system that are all newsworthy and require the public's attention.
Garrett, thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Garrett Theroff is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Chantel Johnson is a policy and legislative coordinator at California Youth Connection. She's also a current foster parent and a former foster child. She says her organization believes Judge Nash's order is illegal, but would accept it with three crucial alterations.
We asked for three things to happen in order to support it. Allow the youth to make the decision whether the media should have access to their court proceedings. The other thing was that they would be able at any point to close that proceeding. And the third one was to study the impact.
The impact of media in the courtroom.
Correct.
The reason for opening the courts is to allow the media to shine a light on a broken system. Do you think the system is broken?
I do think the system is broken, and we have all types of recommendations that the state legislatures and the county representatives need to make. opening the courts isn't going to change those recommendations. We already know what the problems are.
But what about the argument that these stories from the courtroom could breathe life into long-known dry statistics and could actually motivate the public to take action?
We ask at what cost. People don't understand what really happens in a courtroom. We have rules on the federal level about health privacy rights, education privacy rights. This is basically exempting children from that because we're talking about grades they get in school, what their special education status is, what health concerns each one of them have, paternity tests. And some of these things are a deep concern when you're talking about your own privacy.
I totally get that. On the other hand, as Garrett told us, the public often doesn't hear about these kids who are at risk until after they're dead because there's so little transparency in the courtroom. Do you see that argument?
No. A lot of the child deaths that have happened in California actually have never been in the dependency court system. We're talking about Child Protective Services reports that actually never made it to the court level. So opening our court system isn't going to help oversee that. The other thing is that we know that the system is overburdened. Just shining a light on it isn't going to make the legislators make any different choice.
But isn't that the whole point of publicity? To keep pounding away at the issue until somebody takes some action.
Right. We need to look at the specific rules about what allows the media in, but doing this blanket order on an overall level is taking away the protections we've put in place for our children.
This isn't a trivial matter for you. Can you recall for us what the experience in a courtroom might be like for a kid?
Within 72 hours of being removed from your parents, you're sent to court. So you've been taken away from your parents. You've been put into a new home with people you don't know, which is also traumatic. And then you're brought back to court. The first time you've seen your parents in a few days is in a courtroom. You're asked to detail your abuse and neglect. You have social workers talking about you, attorneys arguing on both sides. And all of these things are extremely personal.
When you were in court, did you ever wish that reporters were there?
No. If given the choice, I would not have allowed the media into my courtroom. I was in the child welfare system multiple times. They were never good circumstances. What happens in a normal family when there's an issue, when there's a problem, you know, families do whatever they can to keep it internal to their family. And I think just because we're talking about foster children, they deserve the same right.
Chantel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chantel Johnson is a legislation and policy coordinator at California Youth Connection.
I heard that you're settled down, that you...
Last Sunday, Adele's song Someone Like You won the Grammy for Best Pop Solo Performance, a song notorious for evoking intense emotion, notorious enough to earn this mocking tribute last year from Saturday Night Live.
Ladies, I'm no dummy. You both needed a good cry, so you were listening to Adele, Someone Like You. Do you do it too? Everyone with a heart and an iTunes account does. So I know it, I get it, and I want in.
What is it about this song that arouses so much emotion? Daniel Levitin, a professor at McGill University and author of This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs, says that at least some of this overwhelming response can be explained by science.
We've been using a number of different ways in my laboratory. One is we have people move these volume knobs in response to music in real time, and they tell us when they're feeling thrills and chills, when they're bored. And this creates 100 data points per second, and we can figure out where the moments in the music are.
Give me an example.
Well, one thing we've been using is the Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven. It begins, interestingly, in a similar way to Adele's song with an arpeggiated chord. That's a broken chord. Instead of being played all at once, the notes are played one at a time. At about the point when the right hand starts playing the melody four measures into the piece, there's this burst of feeling. In general, what's going on is that what we want as listeners is for music to surprise us, but not too much.
the music was completely surprising, we'd be disoriented. On the other extreme, if the music was completely predictable, we'd grow bored of it and it would seem banal. And what the composer has to do is find that balance and get it just right, the Goldilocks zone.
You cite Joni Mitchell as a master of the just right amount of surprise.
I think she is, and she uses something that's called an appoggiatura. She hits a note that's out of the key or a bit off and then glides into the right note. And that creates a certain amount of tension in the listener, and then Joni will slide in with a kind of, and hit just the right note.
Up in the sterilized room where they let you be lazy.
And the other way in which a great song, it's having a certain amount of repetition and then violating that repetition in interesting ways. Stevie Wonder's Superstition, the hi-hat that starts the tune, it's constantly changing. And so instead of going, which any other drummer would do, Stevie, who's a fabulous drummer, goes, that's an example of something that could have been simple that's made interesting by its growing complexity.
So Adele seems to use all of these qualities in that song, Someone Like You.
The beginning is so simple. It's an arpeggio, broken chords. We've heard this 1,000 times before. From Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, Meatloaf, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And it almost seems like nothing special could possibly happen. And then she couldn't have a simpler melody. It's 4 notes. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
I heard that you're settled down, that you.
That is the first verse. But then she surprises us. When she gets to the piece of music that comes between the verse and the chorus, suddenly there's this frantic, frenetic tempo. And you realize from the words, I hate to turn up out of the blue uninvited, but I couldn't stay away, I couldn't fight it. She's stalking him. Then the music has this obsessive quality to it with all those verbal syllables coming in. And then before you know it, you're in the chorus. Her voice jumps up an octave, so much higher than she'd been singing before, you couldn't have predicted she would go there. And in that very first line of the chorus, she hits that appoggiatura where she slides into the word you, and you kind of feel like the train's gone off the rails when she hits that wrong note, and then she saves it again.
She does something that you call a vocal fry.
This is a term used by linguists to refer to a tendency. I hate to say this, but this is something that Kim Kardashian does, of all people.
Mm-hmm.
When she talks, she uses a kind of scrapey lower part of her register, and she kind of talks like that. And when a singer does that, as Adele does, it communicates emotion. It sounds like their voice is at the breaking point. She does it in the first verse.
It isn't just about the song, it's also about the performance.
There can be songs that a great singer can save, and there can be great songs that a bad singer can't hurt.
So we've gone over how you can affect people compositionally and how you can affect people with your performance. But another thing that you've noted is that there are certain techniques that used to work and don't work anymore.
If we listen to a Bill Evans record today, 150 years ago, that would have been considered very, very dissonant, and many of us find it very soothing. Our ears have evolved.
People rioted at Beethoven.
They did, and they stormed out of one of his symphonies. They weren't ready for it.
So, do you anticipate that there'll be a time when Adele's song ceases to move us?
I wouldn't take that bet. There's enough nuance and attention to detail and enough power intrinsic to her performance of the song and the song itself. I wouldn't be surprised if it lasted a long time.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Daniel Levitin is a professor at McGill University, and he's also author of This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in 6 Songs. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.